Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello and welcome to Cloud 259 Running on Air. I'm Greg Lemo-Stein. I'm with my co-host, Bren Jones. It's November 6, 2013, 3 days after the New York City Marathon, and we have another race report for you. No elite guests, no regular features, just an update from the man himself, Bren Jones, who broke 3 hours in a big way in New York. Bren, you skipped Cloud 259 and went all the way to Cloud 256. Tell us about it.
Well, thanks, Greg. You know, I think happy race reports are oftentimes less interesting than races reports from races that don't go well, so I'll try to keep it short. But it was a breakthrough race. I'm very grateful to, first off, you, Greg, for helping me in training, giving me good advice over time, and also to all the great athletes that we've had and coaches that we've had, both amateurs who are better than we are but not professionals, and also the professional runners who gave us advice during these shows that I was thinking about constantly during the race that really helped. And it was a bit of a monkey off the back, and it was a fantastic feeling seeing the clock near the finish line when it said 256 something, and I knew that I would have to really stop and crawl to not finish under three, and I was able to stumble across in 256.40. So it was a great day for me.
Well, that's awesome. Were there any? There must have been a bunch of tips that you had in your mind either before or during the race that we heard along the way from the pros.
Mm-hmm. The major ones, not that I thought of, I didn't think of this one during the race, but I think of the training tips, the most helpful one was Nick Arcinaga when he said 18-mile, do an 18-mile marathon pace run, or actually a marathon pace minus 5 seconds per mile run. So James Chu, who we had on, one of our first guests, runs for North Brooklyn Runners. He gave us the advice to do 15 miles at marathon pace. And then Amy Begley came on. You know, the Olympian really reinforced the, the coach's opinion by saying do 12. And then we told her that, you know, James said 15. She said, oh, well, yeah, I was thinking 15. And then Arcinaga said 18. And the reason that Arcinaga stands out for me is that he raised the bar. And I think when you really want to have a breakthrough performance, you need to raise the bar in training. I think so often we emphasize, you know, how hard, you know, you work during the race or the drama of the race, when really I think it's the training. It's all about the training. Now, during the race, I'd say the advice that Alan gave, that Jeffrey Eggleston gave sort of as an aside, and that, you know, I've discussed with you over time about when do you start racing the marathon. And for me, I was looking at this not as a 10-10-10, which is actually what several of our Central Park guests said, Alan, and what Glenn Redpath said, but as 16-10, which is I'm going to go easy for 16 miles and then I'm going to race the last 10. For me, that was important to hold back for a little longer than I otherwise might, and it really worked for me. And Alan did actually mention that was a good place to start, you know, when he would start moving, if he felt, he was having a good day, he would feel untethered from his watch, I think, at that point. And the last 6 miles, you know, what everyone talks about, hitting the wall at mile 20, the last 6 miles, how tough that is. I was just thinking of Lauren Fleshman's advice, and she told us two things. One was, the Kenyans told her, she said, just run faster. That's what the Kenyans told me. But her real advice was, prepare counter arguments for yourself for those last 6 miles when things are hurting. But also think about your strengths and not about your weaknesses. Focus on your strengths, not your weaknesses. So there were some downhills on the course, like on the Queensboro, where I was thinking about my strengths. I'm a better downhill runner than uphill runner. And so that gave me confidence. And as far as preparing counter arguments, I thought about this a lot before the race, but at mile 20, I didn't want to be thinking very much. It was too much to think about counter arguments. So I just thought in my head, Lauren Fleshman. So I was just saying the name again, those last Lauren Fleshman, Lauren Fleshman. And that, to me, just sort of represented, like, all of the advice that we've gotten from these professionals. And I'm not gonna back down in the last 6 miles. You know, I'm not going to give in to whatever pain I'm feeling and not make this goal because I have, you know, I sort of had the strength, you know, the wind behind my back, so to speak, the strength of all of these professionals' advice. But, you know, that said, there was some advice pros didn't give us because they didn't know my particular circumstance with races in the past that was also very important, and that was just about fueling during the race. I've screwed up these races enough times that I knew I had to do something different beyond the training, and that was, you know, I drank Gatorade at just about every stop, and I had 3 goos during the race. And in the past, I hadn't really practiced with the goos. I'd had up one or two and then thought, oh, I don't need this, or I'm having trouble getting it down. This time, I was very focused on taking down the goos and on drinking the Gatorade. I didn't drink very much water. I only had water when I had the goos. But I believe that that probably helped me a lot as well.
Can you tell us about how confident you felt, even on that first 16 miles where you weren't really racing yet?
I didn't feel confident. The low point of the race, I think, was probably the first mile. I was just waiting for that first mile. I was waiting for the clock, and I was starting to think maybe they didn't put the clock on the bridge, you know, as unlikely as that is. But I thought I had remembered that the clock was at the very top of the bridge, but on the lower level, it's not. It, you know, you go over the top, and then you're coming down when you finally see the mile marker. And I saw that the I was looking at my mile splits for the first 8 miles, actually, because I was tapping them on my watch, and I knew that after that that they would be captured by the mats, and I wanted the data. So I was looking just for the first 8 miles at the mile splits, and the first one was high 740 something, and I had a 25-second offset from the start, so it said 8 something. But I looked at my watch, and I saw that it was, I think, 7:48, which is a little slower than what I did in 2010. And I was anticipating, just based on my better fitness, that I would be through the mile at about 7:30. And even that, to me, seemed like it would be conservative. And then when we hit the 5K, I saw the clock said 22-something, and I thought, uh-oh. You know, I thought, given my better fitness, that it would say I would have a 20-handle or a 21-handle there. You know, I was thinking I didn't want to go any faster than 20 minutes or, you know, 20 low might be a bit quick. But, you know, I certainly wasn't thinking it would be 22. It was just a hair above 22. But at that point, I was a little disturbed. but I just thought, all right, well, just keep plugging along. You know, I didn't panic. And then I saw that my mile splits after that were 6:50-something, 6:40-something, sort of more in line with what I had run, what I was expecting to run, I should say. And from that point on, the race slowly got better for me. And the one thing I had in my mind, too, was that in training runs, as we've spoken about before, that first, you know, mile or two of training runs, I usually am a little off, a little slower than target.
Right. What about the wind? You said the wind was figuratively at your back because of all the great advice we got, but it was literally in your face for the first 20 miles. How did that feel?
Yeah, well, it felt like the wind was sort of back and forth. It felt like it was coming from all directions, really. I was anticipating the worst there, too, you know, thinking of, I've run on the track before when there's a very strong wind on one side of the track and you really feel like you're having a hard time moving at any kind of pace. And it wasn't that bad. I'm sure it was harder for the people, for the professionals who were, you know, didn't have anybody to break the wind for them or were running alone or in a small pack. But there are tons of runners out there. So, you know, they did help to break the wind. I noticed the wind, but it didn't, I really didn't think during the race that the wind was slowing me down much. But if you compare the times, not only among the professionals, but, you know, I finished, I think, 5 18th in this race, and the person who finished 5/18th in 2011 came through in 2:52, and my time was 2:56, so 2:56:40. So I can take heart that at least, you know, if you assume an equal field, these times my time might have been, you know, 4 minutes slower than the conditions a few years ago. That said, I'm very sensitive to the sun and to the heat, so that it was overcast, I thought, was good for me. The temperature was perfect, and the wind didn't really get in my head once the race started. I certainly was thinking about it a lot before the race.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, and on the bridges, it was, you noticed it more on the bridges. And in the approach to the Queensborough Bridge, for some reason, I noticed the wind there a lot. And even a bit of rain. I mean, the weather was kind of strange. It was sunny at one point, and it was raining at another point.
And you had said the top of the Queensborough Bridge, a little bit before mile 16, would be your point to start dropping it down, or at least you would know how you were going to feel. Were you confident there?
I was gaining confidence because at the sort of as we go through the race at mile 10, I saw the clock said 68, and I thought, okay, that's sort of on the high end of what I was hoping it would say, but I still felt all right. And by that point, I think I had passed the 3-hour pace group, which was going up Lafayette. Interestingly, I passed the 3:05 pace group and then the 3:10 pace group. So the pace groups they were a little reversed. But then I passed the 3-hour pace group, and at mile 10 is also where I passed Alan Rubin, who we had on the show last week. And Alan, I knew, was, you know, a great person to a great proxy for 3 hour for running sub 3. So I was starting to feel a little better, and at the halfway mark. Which I never feel good at the halfway mark. It's on a bridge, and it's kind of a tough point in the race. I saw that my time was 1:28 high, so I didn't know exactly, but it seemed to me about 1:28:50 or something. And I thought that doesn't leave much room. I felt fine, and I was passing people, so that was encouraging because I generally am not passing people at that point. But I thought it's going to be tight. It's very difficult to run a negative split in New York. You don't see many people run negative splits in New York, so it's going to be tight. Now, by the time we got to the Queensborough, I was still passing. I was passing people on the uphill of the Queensborough, and this, again, I've never passed people on the uphill of the Queensborough. I'm usually falling back at that point. So that was very encouraging. But again, I had in my head, well, look, because everyone's positive splitting this thing, so the fact that I'm passing people doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to break 3 because they're all slowing down a lot. Maybe I'm slowing down a little bit. And then also it was sort of my head at that point was in a strange place because I was thinking, for some reason I thought, I had convinced myself that the 16-mile mark was at top of the Queensborough, when actually the 16-mile mark is well down the hill on the other side, like closer to First Avenue.
Right.
But I did allow myself to not abide by the 16:10 plan and really make it a 15.5, 10.5 plan, right? Like once
right.
I hit the top of the Queensborough, and even a bit before, as I was nearing the top, I picked it up a little bit, and coming down the Queensborough really felt good because I wasn't running that fast, but the people who were ahead of me certainly were not running as fast as they had been running early in the race, and I was just blowing by people, and that felt pretty good. I mean, it felt like I was in a separate race from them. And really, that's how much of the second half of the race played out. On First Avenue still, you know, it was just, I was running 6:30s or 6:40s, and it seemed like most runners at that point were running 7:10 or 7:20 or maybe even slower. So, you know, from that point on, it was a matter of just thinking of it as a half marathon, a 10-mile race, and trying to just keep going. Mm-hmm. I never hit the wall.
Right.
So it was a lesson to me. I had, after the Boston Marathon that we both dropped out of, at this point, Greg and I, we were both writing pieces from time to time on a website called Turfcasts, which is still up there if anyone wants to go back to the archives. And in my race report from that Boston, I had written about how, you know, a marathon is about, you know, you have to learn how to work when the tank is empty and you got to spit in the dragon's eye over the last 6 miles and this sort of thing. And I guess what I learned from this race, or how I might change my philosophy there, is that for me, this race, it wasn't really about, you know, fighting a dramatic fight when the needle is empty. It was about keeping the needle from hitting empty,
right?
So, and to keep the needle from hitting empty, I think what it took for me was the long marathon pace tempo runs, like not just one of them, you know, one workout isn't going to make or break a marathon training cycle, but a series of them. And then the fueling of the Gatorade and the Goose, being very careful about that. So being in better shape and being better fueled, I was able to keep the needle from hitting empty. And as a result, it really did feel like the easiest marathon that I've run. I mean, and it was by far the fastest. The one when I ran, tried to beat Lance Armstrong and I ended up running a 3:21. That was the most difficult marathon I've run because I was toast by mile 12. And really, in retrospect, I don't know how I got through those last 14 miles. And that's the way it is for a lot of people. I mean, if you look at the data on the splits, it's really a difficult a more difficult experience perhaps than it needs to be. And I guess that brings me to the major point I want to make about this. On the Turfcasts, one of the pieces that I wrote was called Aesop Weeps, and I did a little bit of a data dive on the New York City Marathon results and the splits. And in looking at the top 100 finishers in each age bracket, so looking at basically the better runners in the race, I found in 2010 that only 3.5% of men and 8% of women ran negative splits in New York. So combine that, you get about 5% of the top runners ran negative splits. And then if you take into account the entire field, certainly, you know, I'd say 96 or 97% of runners did a positive split. So there, we have a listener who got in touch with me on Facebook named Elliot Bank, who ran New York, and he ran a good race, 3:06, 37, and his PR is 3:25, so he's right on the cusp of breaking 3. And he did the good work of looking at this year's splits. He did the same thing. He looked at the top 100 in each age bracket and found that, again, 8% of women, of these top women, ran negative splits, and 7% of the top men ran negative splits. So it seems like the men have improved a little bit in their pacing relative to 2010. But again, if you consider the entire field and how, you know, the top runners are more likely to do a negative split, I would venture again that probably 95% of runners in the 2013 New York City Marathon did a positive split. Now, if our show can teach people something, hopefully it's that if the advice that the pros gave us and the different approach to training that I took could help me, and I was solidly in the positive split camp, run a 12-minute breakthrough and go from 3:08 to 2:56. I mean, that's a good leap. Then it should be able to help our listeners. Like, we're not just doing this for jollies. Like, this should be able to help people both run faster marathons and just have better marathon experiences. And so the race was very, I guess, satisfying from that perspective, and it was almost like a proof of concept. It isn't exactly the phrase that fits, but you know, if this website is a concept, then it was proof, or this podcast a concept. It seemed to me some proof that it was working.
Right.
So that was really, I think that was important. And I'll say that the end of the race was really fantastic. A few things happened. You know, I had been thinking about, you know, I want to be racing in Central Park. What is it like to be racing in Central Park and not just shuffling through Central Park? So I get to Central Park, and I'm not feeling great. I have a bit of a stomach I had a little bit of a stomach cramp. It was the first time I had a cramp in the entire race. But still, I was breezing by people who had been who were shuffling as I had shuffled in marathons past doing this. And, you know, just thinking, keep going, keep going. I see I had about 17 minutes to do the last 2 miles, and I thought, you know, I think I should be able to break three, but still I wasn't sure. And, you know, because I thought maybe I had been slowing down. I had no idea by how much. But as we get to Cat Hill, which is about, I think, a mile and a half or 2 miles from the finish, I hear people start yelling for Joni. And then I hear someone, and it's funny, you know, I was so keyed in on the race, but I can pick up on the fans saying, go, Joni. And then I thought, oh, that must be Joan Benoit Samuelson. And sure enough, there she was, just like, you know, 10, 15 yards ahead of me. And I thought, oh, that's cool. it sort of distracted me from, from the building drama, I guess I was feeling. And I thought, all right, well, I got to go catch her. And so I went, as we're exiting the park, I started running beside her, and I glanced over, and sure enough, it was her. And, this was a thrill of a lifetime. I mean, she won the 1984 Olympics, the marathon in the Olympics. I mean, this is an Olympic gold medalist. And sure, she's in her mid-50s now, right? and we can't expect her to be in exactly the same form, but she's a competitor, and her legs are flying, and that felt really nice. And then finally, on Central Park South, as I'm trying to put a little distance between me and Joni, hoping she doesn't use some kind of Jedi tactics and fly by me at the end, there were a bunch of very low, extremely low-flying, I don't know if they were seagulls or some other kind of bird, but, and so then, you know, I just thought again of Lauren Fleshman and the other women on Wazelle who joined us on the show, and how, you know, they stick a bird on it, to use a Portlandia phrase, on their singlets. And, Wazelle means bird in French. And it was just nice. I mean, I'm not a huge believer in signs or anything. I don't think that there's some greater power trying to say something to me. But it was just a nice coincidence there. And it made me grateful again for the time that the pros have put in talking to us. And it was just a really nice feeling. And then turning back into the park, running up that hill, I had a little dry heave on Central Park South, and then going up the hill, I felt muddy for the first time, like my legs just weren't moving very quickly, and that is a steep little hill at the end there. Mm-hmm. And but then I saw the clock, and I got close, and, you know, I raised, it was about 50 meters to go, I raised one of my arms, and the people in the bleachers there, I mean, they're cheering for a lot of people, but I heard like a roar of shouts and cheers and encouragement, and that felt so good. I mean, people, the legend about the New York City Marathon is you come off the Queensboro Bridge and you hear this roar, and that's not the case. And I'm not the only one who thinks that. There are several other people who've mentioned this, that, you know, that's a little bit underwhelming, actually, after you've been through Brooklyn, where people are on top of you screaming, and, you know, you've already heard all these shouts.
Yeah, just quickly, the reason why it's different than it has, I mean, I think in the past the crowd was closer. It's been pushed back with security fences, so it's actually you're farther away from the noise.
Yeah, yeah, mm-hmm. that's a fair point. So that's changed over the years.
Yeah.
So the legend simply has to change. But what I hadn't thought about, you know, I hear the crowd throughout the race. I wasn't really looking at the crowd very much, but you hear them and it helps you. But at the very, very end, to hear the crowd there and their support there, that felt really good.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just a nice, you know, it was a relief. It was great. You know, I crossed the finish line, and there, standing there, he had just finished, you know, probably a minute before me, was a guy we trained with by the name of Gerd. And, you know, Gerd knew that the goal was to break three, and he gave me a big hug, and always feels good to hug somebody right after the race. But it was interesting, because it was also a reminder to me that, you know, I did meet the goal of breaking three. But it wasn't, I can't say that it was a perfect race in all sense, because there were several guys, Gerd among them, who I thought, you know, who I trained with, and who I thought, you know, on the best of days, I should be beating these guys. And And before the race, I had thought that I might see them late in the race. And I did see one or two of them and pass one or two teammates late in the race who I'd anticipated seeing late in the race. But I didn't catch, you know, three or four other guys who I thought I might see late in the race. And that made me think about the approach. You know, we talk about, I asked Alan, do you run by your watch or do you run by feel? And I generally was running by feel, by my watch a lot early, but generally by feel. But there is a third dimension there, and that's, do you run by teammates or proxies? And the teammates, if I were to try to run this via teammates, I would have taken it out faster so that I would be running with a posse within sight of a posse. And I purposely did not do that this time. But at some point, you know, maybe if I can get in another really good round of training towards the next marathon, if I've got some guys who, you know, like Gerd or like Stephen Curtis, guys who we run with at these workouts who I know are pretty solid low 250s guys, maybe I might try to keep them in sight from the start or, you know, run closer to them and see whether or not that could help me.
That's the beauty of running, Brent. So you had a 12-minute PR, you broke your goal, you had a great race, and then within about 25 seconds, you were thinking, I could do better.
Yeah, and that's how it goes, isn't it? But it's it's a nice thing because, you know, afterwards, also, you know, I've gotten a whole lot of attention over the past few days. I got to say, geez, social media is good for attention. And anybody who wants running pictures of themselves, join a running club and then run the New York City Marathon.
Right.
Because there are loads of pictures out there of Central Park Track Club members, you know, any and all of them, because of the great photographers and fans taking pictures of every single one of us. So, so after the race, you know, if questions are, oh, you're going to have to, you know, change it to Cloud 249 now or blah, 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 you know, James Chu tweeted something about Cloud 249. And at first, right away, I thought, oh, that's ridiculous. That takes too much energy. And then today I'm thinking, you know, if 256 equals 254 in 2010, you know, and given all the progress made in this training cycle, would 249 be out of the question? Maybe not. But that's, you know, I think I certainly didn't. One thing I did not want to do for this race was I didn't want to overreach. So,
right.
You know, a few teammates had seen that I had good form in practice were saying, oh, you're going for 250, right? Or are you going for 250? And I was thinking, no. I don't want to make that the goal. I don't want to try to go out in 123 or 124. Like, I got to, you know, one breakthrough at a time. And I don't think in running you can usually dial up breakthroughs, say, okay, I want to have a breakthrough, and you have a breakthrough. So I do feel very fortunate that this happened, and I feel very thankful that I didn't get sick. The weather was a little bit haywire, but it certainly could have been a hell of a lot worse. And that I had I didn't get injured. I had a good block of training. I had a lot of support towards the end with, you know, when my wife was out of town, my grandparents came in and took care of the kids, you know, was well fed. And Greg, I also learned from your, from our last interlude, when you talked about staying calm that last week, you know, if you're really busy at work, maybe sort of dialing it to 90% and staying calm. And I was really busy at work. That last week was very busy, but, you know, I just stayed calm and I didn't get stressed about it. And I prioritized sleep and everything sort of worked out, with that mindset. So, so that was very helpful. You learn, you know, you learn from other people's experiences as well as your own.
Well, that's great. I couldn't be happier for you. I'll just add that, you know, I saw you at mile 18 and a half and then again at mile 21. And talk about calm. You looked really cool, really focused, more than anything, really dialed in. We didn't even talk. You were just...
Mm-hmm.
Just really resolute on the task at hand. I guess at that point you weren't certain that you wouldn't hit the wall, like we talked about.
Right.
You didn't.
Right.
You didn't. But you were kind of like a surgeon in a sense, not in terms of what you were doing, but if you walk in the door of an operating room, the surgeon's not going to go, "Hey, how you doing?" and give you a high five. He's focused on the task at hand, or she. That's kind of like what you are. You're just looking ahead, and but then you did stick out a fist, and we had a little fist bump at mile 18, and that was cool. But you were saving your energy, and you were definitely focused. That was really cool. I'll learn from that in my next race.
It felt, I mean, I'm trying to, we don't want to lose the experiences of the marathon. Like, we don't want to lose the memories of them, right? And I was trying to think over the past few days, like, what actually do I remember from that race? And I don't remember a hell of a lot, but I think it's because I was very in the moment, I think.
Yeah.
Like, I was very focused. Because I've run New York several times before, I knew what to expect from the course to a certain degree. And I was not, the crowd is amazing, the noise is amazing, but I wasn't really looking at it. There was a stretch at mile 12, at mile 11, I saw my wife and my kids, and my sister was doing the water stop at mile 12, and then my boss was, you know, cheered for me at mile 12. And, you know, I loved seeing my wife, and I loved seeing my sister, and those were great moments. And then I just, you know, snapped right back to, okay, like, I don't want to get too high or too low at any moment. Like, just keep moving, you know.
Right.
So I guess those are, you know, the image of my wife and the image of my sister I have in my head, like the image of our colleague Chris Donnelly with his iPad trying to take a picture. I think that was kind of a funny one that I saw. When I saw you the first time, you know, I wanted to acknowledge you, but I just couldn't turn at that point. It's funny. Like, but it was very helpful, and I felt like I was getting valuable coaching. But I think I was really keyed in.
Yeah.
I was really in the moment. And
exactly.
And that's a great thing. You know, Uli, who we had on the one of our early episodes on Facebook, he posted something about how, you know, the New York City Marathon is the best sporting event, you know, in the world. And a few things like 2 hours, 49 minutes and 50 seconds of, you know, the best event in the world. And that's how long it took him to finish. And, you know, he's probably in that zone too. I mean, it's the payoff for all of the training is that when the race goes decently, you are in a sort of an elevated place, and you're getting cheered like you never would in any other walk of life unless you're really accomplished.
No, it's a big platform. It's a big stage, the New York Marathon.
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
You mentioned Uli. Should I run through the other performances by our guests at New York?
Yeah.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
We had seven, you know, we haven't been around that long, but we've had seven guests who ran, and one co-host. Ryan Vail was the top American and 13th place overall in 2:13.23. You know, I think the wind affected a lot of the elites, and I think Ryan was probably looking for a better time, but still, we think it was a great performance by him. Jeffrey Eggleston was 14th place in 2:16.35. Jason Hartman was in the mix early but didn't finish, surprisingly, but we suspect he'll be back soon, maybe at Boston, mixing it up like he has the last 2 years. Alan Rubin, Mr. Consistency, a 2:58.49, his 26th straight New York City finish, and I think it's 24 in a row under 3 hours now.
Straight sub threes, yeah. And he was 1:29.55 at the half, so he was really cutting it close,
but
he came through with the negative split. And truth be told, after I passed him, I was like, man, I'm cutting it close. I'm sure Alan is cutting it close because he's behind me. But
yeah,
he did it. He pulled it off.
That's a great job by Alan. And Uli, as you mentioned, with a 2:49. That's his fifth New York under 2:50. He actually has a 2:32,
wow,
which is incredible.
Wow.
For mainly a bicycle racer, right? And that's his,
yeah,
primary
and a new
sport.
Dad, too. He's,
and
he
a new
had
dad. Congrats
yeah,
on many fronts to Uli. Sally Burgesson, the CEO and founder of Wazel, who we had on the show, ran her first marathon in a few years. She ran a 3:20, and it was her first New York City marathon in 8 years. So good race for Sally. And then James Chu was the last entrant. I think he decided to run, it looked like on Twitter, that he decided to jump in like 2 or 3 days before, or maybe within the last week, certainly.
Yeah, it was 2 days before. I think he
two
had
days before.
Some buddies came to town, and they had a free entry.
And he hadn't done a training run longer than 10 miles, and he put together a 3:25 in his marathon debut. He's a crazy man, officially.
Well, I think he proved his own advice. And I think he got some flack for this from,
right.
jokingly, from his running club, from North Brooklyn Runners, because there was, I think, a night where he was giving the marathon tips, and he gave us a tip. You know, do your fifth. You got to practice what you're gonna race. You got to practice it, and he didn't.
He
said
yet.
His long run
Absolutely
is
not.
10 miles, and he didn't do any of that. And then he was quite honest about it, though. I loved seeing on Facebook he said that his goal was to break 3. So he had that same goal. And he said he worked hard over the summer. He ran 4:40 at the Fifth Avenue Mile, and he's this very skilled runner,
yep.
and he knows what
Absolutely.
He's talking about as a coach. And it was interesting that he sort of did something that would be counter to, I think, he certainly didn't train for the marathon, and then he ran the marathon.
Well, he's set himself up for maybe a 30-minute PR next year or something like that.
Yeah, that's for sure.
Yeah.
And in a way, he proved his own advice, you know, because he didn't do that stuff. I did do that stuff. You know, he's a better runner than I am, but not at the marathon the other day because he didn't do the work that he had
right.
said you need
right.
to do.
I also noticed there were 50,304 finishers, which was a record. And Bren, you finished 5:18. So maybe here's a goal for you next time: get in the top 1%, because you just narrowly missed it.
That's it's interesting you mentioned that, because one of my goals was to be the top 1,000, and so
uh-huh.
I was psyched that I was in the top 1,000. And
yeah.
really, if you can improve by a few minutes, then you move up the ranks pretty quickly.
That's right.
So it is an interesting, it's not just time goals, I think, at New York or perhaps some other marathons. It's the place goal that also
mm-hmm.
can be quite interesting. And
yep.
and it's definitely a carrot out there, because it does feel good to, you know, almost the top 1%.
Amazing. I mean, these are a bunch of, like, people, they're all marathoners. They all train a lot, and you're like basically on the cusp of the top 1% of those runners. A 1%er.
Almost a 1%er. I feel like I'm sort of proving how much of an underachiever I've been for a long time.
Right. Right.
Because, you know, I've run since, you know, since high school. I ran high school, ran some in college. I guess I took some time off after college, but it's been a long time. So it's interesting. The last thing I'd like to really comment on is I'm 39 years old. I'm almost 40. And so this breakthrough's hitting me at age 39. I got a few kids, like, you know, I'm not completely neglecting my family here. So for listeners out there who, you know, have time goals in the marathon or want to have a really good marathon experience where you're not just shuffling the last 10 miles or 6 miles and feeling like death, I think there is a way to do it. And as far as the training goes, you know, the training trumps age at this point. At some point we will all slow down, but at age 39, at least, if you train better, you can improve your times, assuming you haven't trained like a maniac your entire life and sort of have nowhere to improve. But for most of us, there's a lot of slack in how we've trained in the past. And it, for us, Greg, I know, you know, like, run-life balance is a big thing, and sort of where do you fit in the runs is important. And I would not have been able to do this if I had not been running at lunch pretty much every day, running home from work, occasionally running to work, running really early on the weekend mornings or late on a Sunday night, like, to get the long run in. There is time to do it. There is a way to do it and get in 70 miles a week and not put your life on tilt. So I think that that's sort of a lesson. Like I feel like I've certainly, my life has been focused on the marathon to a certain degree, but I don't think that I've completely turned it upside down. I think there's a way to get it done. And inertia is very powerful. So if you just get in the routine of running at lunch every day, you'll do it every day. You don't even think about it. You just do it. So that is that can really help.
Well, very good. Congrats again. And onwards. And we're not changing the name of the show because you have a co-host that still has some work to do.
Well, speaking of, Greg, all right, so we've gotten one over or under the bar, depending on how you want to look at it. What's next for you?
So I will be running in, I guess, a week and a half. The Bucks County Marathon is the one I chose. It's a smallish race in Pennsylvania, not far from New York. A couple of reasons why I picked it. It's flat. It's basically along the towpath along the Delaware River, so it's an entirely flat course the whole way. The biggest hill is literally 10 steps at mile 8 that you basically have to bound up, and that's basically the only hill.
Mm-hmm.
And in our episode 14, Jason Hartman's tip was to find a flat course. That was the first of his two tips.
Mm-hmm.
As I said, it's pretty convenient in New York, and we talk about run family balance. I don't want to travel a great distance for a second fall marathon after having gone up to Hartford. So this is just an hour and a half drive away from New York. And it's a small race, which kind of appeals to me. I like the big stages, but I also like the smaller races. This field is limited to 500 runners. And we just mentioned that you finished 518 in New York, so this means I'm more or less guaranteed to finish higher than you in Bucks County. No matter what my time, I'll have a higher place than you. But
and you ran it last year, and what was your time last year at Bucks County?
Well, last year I ran it without really much of a time goal at all. I had run, this was before we started our show, I had run a marathon on Long Island, the Hamptons Marathon, in 3:11, which is my second fastest marathon. I felt pretty good about that. Despite some heel issues. I had some plantar fasciitis back then. So I jumped in a race at Bucks County, or registered for a race at Bucks County, but then I got sick. So I had a long stretch right before the race where I didn't run at all, like 10 days, and then felt better by the time race came around, but I only ran once before the race. So I really just went in just to experience the marathon scene. It really was not any kind of anything close to a PR attempt. I ran in the high 340s. I think mm-hmm. I wanted to keep the first half to 2 hours just to keep myself from trying to do something rash and getting injured. And it turns out actually I did get injured from that, I think, because I hadn't run much beforehand. My knee was bothering me after that race. But anyway, I did experience the course. It's beautiful. Lots of trees, lots of obviously gorgeous river views, and it's flat. The one interesting thing about it is there are lots of little bridges over the towpath, and they're only about 6 feet high, so occasionally I have to duck. It's like the only marathon I've ever had to duck before, but that doesn't slow me down too much. but there's good fan support on those little bridges, so it's a cool little race. So we'll see how it goes. We'll have more to say about whether I'm actually going to be making a run for three. I think I will, but I may just be going for a PR, which is sub 3:08, and then be looking to break three in the spring. We'll see how it goes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It might be a two-stage process. Getting from 3:08 to sub three for me might be a two-stage process.
Well, we'll see. We shall see. A lot depends on the weather, right? And that's out of your hands.
That's right.
But if it's a flat course, that's good, and it's great to see that you're going to get a second shot this fall, and knock on wood, you don't get any stomach bugs.
Yep. We'll hope to have a show next week before that, so we can finalize the race strategy at that point.
Sounds good.
We
right,
just wanted to mention
indulging me, and now I guess I have to move on and do other things in life other than just think about my marathon.
Yeah, you can bask in the glory a little bit more.
No.
We'll give you a few more days.
Glory's over. Work.
Just want to mention you mentioned a reader who's contacted you with some of the
yep.
split data. Another reader, Calum Johnson, emailed us at cloud259@outlook.com. We encourage everyone to email us with their goals or their performances. Calum broke his goal of a sub 305 by 6 seconds at the Detroit Marathon a few weeks ago, which actually got me thinking that, you know, the 305 goal may be a good one for me, because now Calum has bagged that and he's going to be looking to break three in the spring, perhaps at Boston. But congrats to Calum. It's a real inspiration, and he included a link to a write-up where he describes his evolution as a runner, and he had battled weight issues in college, and when he first ran a half marathon, he ran a 3:15 for a half, and now he's a 3:04 guy. He's on cloud 3:04, so congrats to Calum, and we love to hear stories like this. They're really inspirational.
Yeah, it's fantastic. Calum does have a good story. Man, the work he's put in. More mileage than what we've done.
Right.
Yeah, it is wonderful to hear stories from the field. Thank you all so much for getting in touch.
Yeah, so again, it's cloud259@outlook.com. We also are on Twitter at cloud259blog. Follow us there. Listen to us on iTunes or on the website, and we will be back soon with another elite with some advice and obviously their story. We'll see you next time on Cloud 259.